My name is Timi Makgetla. It's the 9th of February, 2010. I'm in Johannesburg, South Africa, here with Mr. Rolf Meyer, who played an important role in the negotiations process before the 1994 elections representing the government and was appointed Minister for Provincial Affairs and Constitutional Development in the Government of National Unity. Thank you very much for joining and consenting to be part of this interview.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Could we begin with your giving us a brief overview of your career and how you came to be appointed Minister of Provincial Affairs and Constitutional Development?
I entered politics in 1979 as a Member of Parliament for the then National Party. We had constituency-based elections at that stage, and so my constituency was right in the middle of Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And I was from sort of day one confronted with ongoing challenges about the unfolding of resistance against the apartheid system, etc., because the area that I represented was or part of the area was formerly occupied by particularly members of the Indian community in South Africa. They were later on to be removed from there. There was a lot of resistance against that in terms of the policies of those days. Mm-hmm. The area was called Page View. I think that's still the name. And the same happened in the adjacent areas, Mayfair, Fordsburg, and those. So all I'm saying is that right from the early days of my political experience, I was exposed to challenges against the system as it was. I think I can say also I was part of the reformed group within the National Party right from the beginning, those that wanted to see changes happening. But it was a slow process. It was not happening overnight. As we all know, the changes actually only started to begin happening in 10, 11 years later after I entered the political scene. I was appointed first to government in 1986 as Deputy Minister of Police. And I often look back at that as a very specific experience in my own reform process and my own transformation, mm-hmm. simply because as part of my job then, I was responsible for the management of the national state of emergency that was implemented by the government in 1986. Mm-hmm. And so it was part of my job to try and find out what went wrong in every township and every area where there was unrest and, mm-hmm. and violence. And also to try to settle the reasons for the violence. So I was under a lot of pressure in those years, in that particular period rather, when I was deputy minister, traveling to all these so-called hotspots around the country. Mm-hmm. And in the process, getting exposed to real life in the townships, more than any of my colleagues at the time. And I keep on thinking that was a very informative period, in fact, for me to help me to get a better understanding, not only of what was happening in the townships and the reasons for people to resist what was policy at that stage, but also to come to the very clear understanding that, you know, inasmuch as the attempt of government was to settle the scores by means of attending to service delivery, etc., etc., it was about one thing only, and that was politics, mm-hmm. and the democratization, or the need for democratization of the country. And that helped me in my own personal transformation to the extent that by the time that the process started in 1990, I think I can truly say I was already mm-hmm. transformed myself. I concluded my paradigm shift mm-hmm. by then. And that is, I think, it was of major support for my own role that I had to play later on as negotiator and chief negotiator for the government from 1992 onwards. Mm-hmm. So that is in a nutshell, yes, where I was coming from.
That's very interesting. And so we'd like to sort of pick up from that point after 94, when the new provinces had been established and there's been this, you know, great constitutional shift or change to the country's structure. What, for you as a minister, were the main challenges that you faced with respect to these new provincial structures?
I have to go a little bit more in depth into it, to the question to get an understanding of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The ANC started off the negotiations on a very strong belief that we should not only be a unitary state, but also with a very centralist type of structure in terms of governance. Mm-hmm. Therefore, resisting any notion of a federal system and or dividing the country into provinces, even, etc. The National Party at that stage, as part of its negotiating strategy, thought that we should opt for a strong system of devolution of power. Mm-hmm. And there were even parties that felt much stronger about this, like the IFP and others, for their own political purposes, more than for the reasons of good governance, I might say. but there was the belief that if we would devolve powers and competencies to the lowest level, particularly at the regional level, then that would enable them to become a very strong federal state in the case of KwaZulu-Natal. There were even advisors from outside that gave the IFP very strong advice in that regard. And some with some credibility too, that advised them in that regard. To the extent that, you know, there were some that argued during the negotiations almost for a confederal model than more than for even a federal model in the process. What we ended up with, I think, can be called, and that was both in the interim constitution as well as in the final constitution, was probably more of a unitary state with devolved powers to regions than a federal state. And we're still not a federal state in that sense. But at the same time, there are competencies that have been designed specifically for the provinces, and according to the constitution, they have the right to exercise those. And I think what we can say today is we're probably still in the phase of a federal state that can potentially develop into that, you know, over a period of time, depending on how politics move and change. But at the same time, you know, there is not, in what I observe, much tension about the issue right now in the country. At the same time, I think it's important to note that, and that's why I'm saying we still, you know, the call on this is still out there. It's still open because we have political structures in the provinces. We have some competencies devolved to the provinces. And all of those mean that it will not easily go away. Mm-hmm. I would tend to think that anybody who wants at this stage to close the book on the provincial system in South Africa will not have a strong chance of success. Mm-hmm. I think the provinces are there to stay, and be it that, you know, 8 of the 9 provinces are under the ruling party's authority, even that being the case, I don't think there's much chance for the whole system of provincial government to be just dismantled at this point of time.
Mm-hmm. You know, just moving back briefly to that period of negotiations, mm-hmm. when these issues were being thrashed out, you raised the point that the IFP was looking to create a sphere that they might have some political control over. Mm. As a negotiator, how did you engage those issues, or another way to put it is, you know, were there any sort of compromises or bargains that the negotiating partners came out with mm-hmm. that would prevent regional actors creating too much of a sort of local identity and sort of steering those provinces away from the national government?
I think the problem was, you know, the people that argued strongly mm-hmm. in favor of a regional and or federal system were doing it for the wrong reasons. They were doing it for their own political advantage, advantage and benefit, and not so much for the real, you know, issue that was relevant, namely strong regional government mm-hmm. in order to deliver better services to the people, etc. I think if they took that line of thinking, it might have been advantageous for their own negotiating positions, but that was not, and everybody knew that at the back of it was a case of how they could gain as much political position in the whole situation. So the reality is that South Africa is a country, and still is, was then like that, and it still is a country where the wealth of the country is being concentrated in one province mainly, and that is the one where we're sitting, Gauteng, with more than 50% of the wealth of the nation being generated here. And if you look at a true federal system, in my mind, it means that there has to be a better distribution of wealth, so as to enable provinces or regional government to have their own taxing abilities, etc. In this case, we would have had a situation if we had a true federal system in terms of a revenue base. You would have seen certain provinces just not making it, just not surviving, just not being able to carry their responsibility. And I'm thinking here of particularly Northern Cape, Free State, Northwest, probably Limpopo. You can name them. It's all around. And out of the total 9 provinces, only probably 3 would have been able to sustain it if they had to make it on the basis of their own revenue. So the basis for us to have a system of true regional and or provincial of federal government in South Africa, I don't think was not at that stage truly relevant, and even now today. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, a system of devolved government for the sake of bringing government closer to the people, I think is in my mind not only a South African phenomenon. I think it prevails everywhere in the world, and I think for that reason we have designed a system which is closer to what we need. Mm-hmm. The big debate, I think, at this point is rather where does the authority lie between provincial and local. Mm-hmm. And that is a debate which is of a different nature. And like I mentioned earlier, I think Mr. Mohamed Baba will be able to give you good insights into that specific debate.
Great. Well, so as you mentioned, some of these provinces were set up for political reasons, not necessarily because they were financially viable. Mm. When you became the minister and you were now responsible for overseeing the construction of administrations in the sort of diverse range of provinces, what did you regard as the sort of most important things that needed to be done, or the biggest challenges in that area?
Well, our main focus during the first year was actually to attend to the subject of what is called cooperative governance. Mm-hmm. And as you might know, even now the department is called the Department of Cooperative Governance, mm-hmm. which I think is very fit and appropriate. Mm-hmm. And during that period that I was minister in the Government of National Unity, our main focus and emphasis was on that. In other words, to set up provincial structures that could work in cooperation with national government. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, we also formed what was called MINMEX, in other words, ministerial, mm-hmm. and executive committees of the provinces together. We, for instance, had regular meetings under the guidance of the national department with the premiers at the time, mm-hmm. On a regular basis, so as to help us to bring about stability in terms of this relationship issue, but also in terms of the provincial governments, which had to start from scratch at that stage. Mm-hmm. Because remember, before that moment, South Africa was divided into 4 provinces and 9, if I remember correctly, homelands. And all of those had to be, first of all, reconstructed in terms of one unitary state, mm-hmm. but then also again divided into nine new provinces with new boundaries, etc. Mm-hmm. So all of this was a period of implementation. In other words, when we talk about that phase immediately after the transition in 1994, mm-hmm. it was about implementation of what the Constitution mm-hmm. had given us, mm-hmm. Which we all agreed to, but it was now a matter of implementation and making it in practice working. Mm-hmm. So it was a very enjoyable experience mm-hmm. from my angle as national minister responsible for that. And, you know, I came to know my colleagues as provincial premiers very, very closely at that stage, and we had a wonderful working relationship with all of them. And I can truly say, even up till this day, I'm friends with each and every one of them because of that period of us working together. And it was a happy experience to me, mm-hmm. at least. Mm-hmm. What was a more complicating facet, and that is still mm-hmm. not being totally resolved in all of this, is the position of traditional leaders mm-hmm. and traditional affairs. Because as you can imagine, up to that point, the traditional leaders were mainly taken care of within the homeland concept. Mm-hmm. They were specifically based in the rural areas of South Africa, which were homelands. KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, Transkei, Ciskei, Limpopo, it was the Kukuni land, and many, many others, all around the country. In the Free State, it was Kwakwa and those. So they were almost removed from the scene into the homelands all for all the time. And suddenly they were now part of the national scene. And it was then a question, how do you deal with democratic government mm-hmm. and the traditional system at the same time? Mm-hmm. And that was a very complicated part of my portfolio at the time, I must admit, mm-hmm. Where I had, fortunately, the very special assistance of the president then, Mr. Mandela. Mm-hmm. Because of his ability to interact and to communicate with the traditional leaders, and many of them call themselves kings. And whenever I had a problem in that regard, especially as a white person, dealing with them, it was not that easy. But Mr. Mandela, I can recall, went very often with me to meetings and took full responsibility for conducting those meetings with the traditional leaders, in persuading them to accept the democratic model and also their role within that as traditional leaders. But like I said, I think even up till this day that situation has not been completely resolved. And, you know, just purely from the position where they officiate as traditional leaders, their responsibility is much closer to what happens at the local government level mm-hmm. than what is happening at the national or even provincial level. And you know, again, I think the department that is responsible, which is now inter alia called Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, mm-hmm. which I think clearly shows, you know, where the responsibility lies. I think the people involved there would be in a better position to give you some insight as to what is happening right now. I'm a little bit out of touch mm-hmm. as to the current making there.
This is very interesting. Could you just tell us a bit more about what the situation was sort of after 94 with respect to how traditional leaders and authorities were meant to, or what sort of interim constitutional provisions there were for the way traditional authorities related to the various spheres of government?
It was not all that clear in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, the provision was made for traditional leaders to be there. Mm-hmm. Their authority was recognized. But how exactly was it was a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. And it was all meant to be worked out further in terms of the Local Government Act that came into being in 1995, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So it was part of that phasing in process, but nobody was actually totally clear in our minds. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, just to think about it, you have elected local government, you have elected provincial government, you have elected national government. Mm-hmm. and then the traditional authorities, you know, with no democratic base, mm-hmm. so to speak. And how do you relate to them? So there was a, I think in the interim government, local government act, there was a special provision. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit vague on this now because it's 15 years ago. But I think there was special provision in terms of how local authorities had to interact with the traditional authorities in their areas and so on. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, that was a more complicated part and not an easy one to deal with, mm-hmm. especially from the point of view, you know, I was there as minister responsible under the government of national unity. Mm-hmm. And many of these traditional leaders think of themselves as elders. Who is this whitey to come and tell them what to do? Yeah, type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that is why I'm saying Mr. Mandela was often there.
Yeah.
Not so much in in technical terms, but just as a father, mm-hmm. respected also by the traditional leaders. Mm-hmm. And that helped me a great lot.
Mm-hmm. Can you maybe identify some of the key debates at the times and who was representing those interests from the traditional leader side?
From traditional leaders.
Like, what were the demands that were being made, and who were the people who were making demands for traditional leaders to be more involved with state functioning?
Well, you know, they. I must say, my impression has always been, and I think it's still the case, that the traditional leaders are more working in terms of their self-interest mm-hmm. and their local interest than at the national level. You would hardly find the traditional leader, whether it's a king or not, from a particular area, in agreement with one from another area, because their specific interests are hugely different. Mm-hmm. I mean, the king of the Zulus, for instance, think about the Zulu nation, and that's all. Mm-hmm. And the same you would find for those representing the people in the Eastern Cape. Mm-hmm. When they are, if I remember correctly, there were like six different traditional leaders who called themselves kings in the Eastern mm-hmm. Cape region alone. And you would find the same in Limpopo. Not as many, but also, you know, different ones. But the point is, they would regard themselves as leaders of the people in traditional authorities that they conduct power over. And you would not have seen, I didn't at least, see them in much in cooperation all over. I think it was more their specific needs that they were interested in. Mm-hmm. And I can recall, and I won't go by name and specifics, but, you know, it was more about their satisfying their personal needs in terms of their households, in terms of taking care of their vehicles that they should be able to drive around with and mm-hmm. things like that, more than actual care of the people. Mm-hmm. But this is a very sensitive issue, so I should not go too much into that.
This is very interesting because, as you say, it really does show the sort of conflict between ideas of democratic representation mm. and a sort of another source of authority that perhaps isn't as accountable in the same sense. What did the department, or, you know, as minister, did you begin to develop strategies or ways to say, how could you incorporate them without allowing them to abuse their authority or to sort of develop their own sphere?
You know, I was not there long enough to see the outcome. And again, I think you have to speak to the people who are now conducting the responsibility there. But my impression was that, you know, we tried to keep a peaceful relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think we succeeded to a great extent in in helping the development of a situation that could have been potentially tense. Not moving in that direction, by meeting with them, by talking to them, by listening to them, and give them almost what they needed in terms of their personal requirements. Mm-hmm. But at the bigger picture, in terms of real democratic decision making, they were not necessarily participating, and I don't think they really were concerned too much about that. Mm-hmm. And from our point of view, it was, you know, building a democratic state more than anything else. And if we had to allow ourselves to be taken on a detour too much as far as the requirements of traditional authorities are concerned, we would not have been able to build stable democratic government. I think the biggest tensions in that regard came about probably in KwaZulu-Natal. And I keep on thinking today that that the role that Jacob Zuma and others played in KwaZulu-Natal to calm down the aspirations, so to speak, of the traditional communities in KwaZulu-Natal was very fundamental in realizing a peaceful transition in that province. What I'm saying is, I think I think many of the IFP leadership at the time were of the inclination to try and utilize that base to create confrontation with national government, but also at provincial level. And the way in which Jacob Zuma and others persuaded people to stay calm and to accept democratic role, I think was a very important role that they played there. Before the transition, and especially in the period that followed after 94. Just remember, he was then specifically an MEC in KwaZulu-Natal. And I think his role in that regard was of particular importance from a political angle. So it was not so much a constitutional issue, because the constitution was not too clear on the subject. It was not too specific on this. Knowing that, you know, here is a grey area. So it was one of political management more than anything else.
Okay.
And I think the message that one takes out of this is that, you know, in a situation like this, you need leadership, you need guidance, you have to have people who are prepared to sit down and consult and listen, but also give guidance. And I think that is what primarily happened in that particular case.
Okay.
As a case in point.
So
you would like to something to drink?
Oh, no, I'm fine, thank you.
Are you sure?
Thank you, yes.
And on the subject of KwaZulu-Natal, is there anything you'd like to ask related to this?
Well, I guess what I'm quite interested in it is, as you said, it was quite clear to you and some of the other negotiating partners that these sorts of demands were coming not from a demand or a desire for good governance, but for sort of political expediency in some ways. And I was wondering how, as a negotiating partner, you sort of reacted to that or were able to deal with those concerns, knowing that the motives being presented were perhaps not the the real driving force. How you sort of manage those sorts of demands?
Well, if I can look at the broader context, you know, not only and specifically in terms of provincial and or local government and or traditional authorities, but in a broader context, we must remember that the main settlement in South Africa had to come about between those that were in power and those that were most likely going to take power. And those that were mainly going to take power were represented mainly by the ANC. And therefore the actual negotiations had to happen, or let me put it differently, the actual settlement had to come about through an agreement between the National Party government and the ANC. And when I say this, it doesn't mean that we intended to exclude any party from the negotiations. I keep on thinking that part of our success in South Africa was the fact that we succeeded in bringing everybody to the table, or at least created a table where everybody could be and was welcome to be. If they didn't join the table of negotiations, it was their own choice. But that was probably easier said than done, because there were key moments where a settlement was potentially in the making between the government and the ANC at the time, not being approved by others that were standing outside. And the IFP is a very important case in point as far as this example is concerned. We had, for instance, the breakdown of the negotiations in 1992 between all the parties, but in the end also between the ANC and the National Party. That was after the Boy Patong massacre. And the way to get us back on track was that we had to have a one-on-one almost, bilateral, set of talks between the ANC and the National Party government, which happened for a three-month period. Cyril and I were sitting across the table almost on a day and night basis. In the end, it resulted in us coming to an agreement, which was recorded as the Record of Understanding in September of 92. And immediately, once that Record of Understanding was signed between Mandela and de Klerk, the IFP turned everything on us, on both sides, and said, you excluded us, we walk away. We're not going to participate in multi-party talks further. You know, and it was we struggled for 6 months or more to get them back to the table. And that was not on the issue of provincial government or traditional forests or whatever. That was on the main issue, and that is they felt left out of this deal that the government and the ANC made. On the other hand, and this was the complicated part, is we all know between the government and the ANC, if we didn't make that agreement between them and us, we would not have progressed with the negotiations at all. So, you know, it was in the interest of the country, of the bigger picture, that we made that agreement, because otherwise there would have been no progress. But now here was a group representing a specific section of the community that had to be persuaded to come back to the table. Although the table was always open for them, they were not there. And in this process, they persuaded some of the right-wing elements, some of the right-wing Afrikaner, to join forces with them. They formed an organization called COSAC as a result of that. You know, and then suddenly this whole subject of strong demands for devolution of power was the main agenda point for the IFP and the right-wingers. And still till this day you will hear them talk about that. The right-wingers came with the demand from a different perspective. They didn't have exactly the same objective as the IFP had, but they wanted to protect minority rights for the whites in South Africa. So they linked forces with the IFP on that basis, and as a result of which they formed the common position in this organization called COSAC. So suddenly the main debate from their side was, you know, give us more powers, either at the regional level or in terms of minority right protection. And like I said, it took us more than 6 months to get them all back to the table, which only happened in March of the following year. And then soon after that, we had the terrible incident, the assassination of Chris Hani, which almost, you know, spoiled the whole effort to get everybody back to the table. But the outcome of the Chris Hani assassination was that there was then a consensus between the government and the ANC, we have to move forward very quickly. As a reaction to the assassination, because if we didn't do that, the masses would have taken to the streets and demanded immediate takeover. So we suddenly had to manage a new situation from that angle to say, carry on with the negotiation as quickly as possible so that we can get to an agreement on an interim constitution so that we can have an election as early as possible. And the date was actually then fixed for the 27th of April, 1994. So a year in advance, the date was fixed, knowing that if we don't do that, if we don't say to the masses, the date is fixed, you can rest assured about that, there would not have been peace in South Africa. But again, that scared off the demands of, you know, the IFP and their cohorts at that stage. So after a while, they left the table again. And because every little bit of progress that we were making in the negotiations, in the multi-party negotiations at the time. They were resisting them because they didn't want to see progress, because they thought it would take away any chance for them to make an impact. So they walked out in June of 93, and they never came back. And we went on and finalized the negotiations, got agreement on the interim constitution by November of that year. And it was only 6 weeks, as you will recall, it was only 6 weeks before the election that the IFP, knowing that there was no alternative, but missing out on the content of the interim constitution and their participation in that. But knowing suddenly that if they don't participate in the election, they would be nowhere, came back to us and said, how can they participate? And you will recall it was after the ballot papers were already printed. So what is in this message? I think in the message is, if there's an opportunity to participate, don't let it go by. And that is often what is happening in other conflict situations as well, which I've observed.
Quick follow-up. Were you fairly confident that they would rejoin the process, or were there some concerns that they would remain outside of the progress that was being made?
That's difficult to say. I think the dominant factor in our minds was that we realized if we didn't progress, if we didn't go ahead towards the election, there would have been blood in the streets in South Africa. And I think the calculated decision therefore was almost, let's go ahead and do this. We were satisfied with the content of the interim constitution. ANC was satisfied, so let's go ahead and do it. Not only the two parties, but also many others that were still at the negotiating table. There were at all given moments more than 20 different parties at the negotiating table, excluding the IFP and those that walked out of them. So we were confident that we had sufficient reason to go ahead on the basis of what was called sufficient consensus. And it was a calculated decision to say, it's either this or bloodshed. Return to something that nobody could contemplate at that stage. And that is why we went ahead. And in the process, I think the IFP realized that that they had very little option. Just to fill you in on that, there was an international attempt to put pressure on the South African government and the ANC at the time to delay the election. And there was a 7-person team that was sent here under the leadership of Kissinger and Carrington, Lord Carrington from the UK and Kissinger. And they arrived here, I was saying 6 weeks, it was probably just about a month before the election. And they arrived here with a clear intention to persuade us to say, hold back on the election so that you can bring the IFP on board. That was sort of their mandate. And then the very first meeting I had with them, I said to them, I'm sorry, you're missing the point, you're wasting your time. If we're not going to have the election on 27th of April, you're going to cause a conflict in South Africa that we've never had before. Mm-hmm. And I could see in their faces, both Kissinger and Carrington, how, taken aback they were with this arrogance, saying to them, you're missing the point. You're not going to get what you thought your mandate is. And I guess the ANC said to them the same. By means of Cyril. And then a day and a half later, they called me. Kissinger called me and said, we're packing our bags. We're off. Because you're right. They realized it. Through talking to others, of course. And so they went. They left that same day. And it was literally at the airport, with the lazy rushing after them, that this man from Kenya, Washington Okomo, was the only one of that seven group, only one of the seven deaf is still behind. And Buthelezi said to him, but what can I do now? Because he was hoping that this was now his, these big moment, and there they go. And Washington Nkuma said to him, let's go and talk to Mandela and de Klerk and see whether they can accommodate you on the ballot paper. And that's how it happened. They came to us, they saw us in Pretoria. Mandela and de Klerk were there and they were, I think, generous. To say, okay, we will accommodate you. But that's how almost simple it was in the end, you know. Mm-hmm. But the lazy realizing that all his demands were not going to go anywhere. Because the bigger picture was more important than living out in Inkatha, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So,
sorry, that was not part of your.
No, but it's fascinating.
No, I think
this is all. And it's all. So, I was interested also in, just trying to understand. You mentioned earlier that some of these provinces incorporated different administrations. How did you had regular meetings with the premiers. How were decisions about setting up the new provincial administrations taken? Was that something that you gave a lot of input to? Did they primarily drive it, they being the premiers? How did that process go forward?
Well, obviously the interim constitution gave some guidance in that regard in terms of, you know, the formats of the provincial structures. Having their own executives, having their own administrations, etc. That was contained in the chapter on provincial government in the interim constitution. So we had to go by that, and as a result of which we had to, you know, ensure, and we worked it out. I think I can say in a very cooperative way that each province set up its own administration and its own government and so forth. So that to my mind, was not a difficult process, but it took some time before, you know, actual governance kicked in, making sure that it's not only a political exercise, but also really something that could deliver. And you know, quite frankly, in that regard, I think we have made some mistakes in our original design, and probably later on those mistakes, you know, are still visible even today. I think, for instance, we have created two big government administrations at the local, at the provincial level. I don't think there's a need, personally, that's my view. I don't think there's a need for 10 MECs per province in each province, taking into account the liability it puts on the fiscus and state funding. Because, like I said earlier, many of these provinces are just relying on national funding for their own administrations and so forth, and that means that you know it puts an extra burden on government expenditure, which can be reduced, and still that option is there. But this is also why some people would argue there's no space for provincial government. You know, cut it all out so that we can save the money. I don't think that's the answer. I think it's a question of looking at a slimmer administration, because there's no reason why a certain department and or ministry executive at the provincial level can't take responsibility for more than one of its current portfolios, for instance, that type of thing. And obviously I would like to see, again, from my personal angle, I would like to see rather a focus of at provincial level of certain portfolios that are really, really relevant to service delivery. And I can immediately think of education and health. More important than economic services. Of course, economic services and so forth are national issues to a great extent. You don't need an MEC for sport in the province. And they are there in some cases, you know, of culture, or those type of things. But what really matters to the people in the provinces are probably education, health, and good local government services. And my experience is, even today's story, is that decisions at those levels are not necessarily being taken forthcoming.
So why were those portfolios given to provincial government if, as you say, the rationale doesn't suggest that is necessary for that structure of government?
Well, I think it was more a political thing than anything else, you know, and I don't walk away from the decisions. I think that's the kind of mistake that we've made at that point of time, not totally certain as to what, you know, we should be looking at and how we should be creating this. But I think it was, you know, this is probably where the compromise, you know, was created. If you look at the competencies as it is designed in the Constitution, some of those competencies you would ask questions about and say, what the hell, you know, is this really necessary? But it was part of that compromise. And the ANC would say today, well, those guys who wanted federal government demanded that, and so we gave it to them so that, you know, they can be happy. But if you look at the essence of the content, it's not really serious federal powers even for that anger. But it was sort of a way to pacify people and, you know, make them happy and find a compromise. Even in the final constitution, that was the case. Mm-hmm. You look at the devolvement of competencies in the final constitution. It's the same thing. So it was more political than need, I would say.
You know, I've heard people talk about the rationalization that took place in this period, where, for example, if you had the Eastern Cape and you had the former CisGuy administration, the former TransGuy administration, the former provincial administration being brought together, you had a number of director generals and deputy director generals and departments that suddenly became redundant. Did your ministry or did you as minister engage on those issues? And what was some of the strategy to deal with that sort of abundance of personnel?
Well, that was obviously a problem, you know. In some departments it was easier because they were more of a national nature. Let's say, for instance, defense, as an example. There were no defense structures in the new provinces. So the defense forces that belonged to the former TransGuy and CisGuy were immediately consumed into, or taken into the national defense structure, that type of thing. Police would have been the same, and so forth. But when it came down to, again, health and education and so forth, it was more complicated. Because we now had to create new provincial structures for those departments, which didn't exist before. And also to create the right organizational relationships with the national. And that was part of the exercise, very complicated exercise, that happened in that period of installing provincial government in South Africa. I'm probably not the best expert to talk about that because I handled it at the political level. But if you look at how those, you know, structures came into being, it would probably be better to talk to the people who are really responsible for that in the different departments. But it's not an easy exercise, and I think we still have the flaws today to a great extent. I was talking to the Deputy Minister of Local Government just 2 weeks ago about the subject of service delivery at the local government level. And he quite frankly says it's the two problems that they're mainly facing at the moment, and I'm speaking now second hand, and I should not speak on his behalf, but I think that was there right from the beginning. The two problems being that the provincial structure was not knowing exactly how to conduct its authority over local administrations, local authority administrations. And on the other hand, there's the political problem. People being appointed now as political heads of local authorities, as mayors and or town managers, city managers, from a political angle, because they are serving the party structures and not because they are the best administrators. So, you know, all of this is not being ironed out completely yet, even up to this day. And I think we have to revisit some of this. I know there's a bill coming up to Parliament to look at this and to address this. I believe the minister will speak about it soon. And this is, to my mind, something that has to be ironed out. I'm talking here about the area of local government, which I understand a little bit about. I can imagine that within health and in education, you would find the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
Take education, for instance. Service delivery at the education level is a hugely complicated issue because national is responsible for policy.
Mm-hmm.
Provincial is responsible for execution. Now, one can ask the question, where is the dysfunctionality problem in our schools rest in terms of responsibility? You know that South Africa's education problem is huge,
mm-hmm.
with more than 80% of our schools, public schools, being dysfunctional, meaning teachers not in classrooms when they should be there, inter alia. Is that a function of national? Or is it provincial? My answer is immediately provincial because of the natural consequences of the constitution. But if provincial is not taking care of that, then we have to address it from another level. So we have not solved all of this. And again, I think you have to talk to the people who are now responsible in this particular portfolio to get a good understanding of what are the complications to deal with.
Mm-hmm. You know, given that these provincial structures were made responsible for such important areas of service delivery, such as implementation of education policy, when they were being set up, was anything done to provide sort of skills training or management capacity at those levels?
I think one can say yes, there was, but probably not sufficiently, because it was also an integration of an education system that didn't exist before. You know, and to be frank about it, I think the biggest damage that the apartheid brought to this country was in the area of education, more than anything else, and I think we're suffering from that, and we will suffer, unfortunately, it seems, for generations. Because the huge divisions between the way of educating in the public system. We had homeland schools, we had in so-called independent schools within the independent homelands, and all of those had to be integrated with a national education department that existed at that point of time, with four provinces that also existed at that time. So it was a very complicated exercise, and probably the integration of all those took more attention than the actual teaching in the classrooms. And I don't think we have overcome that problem.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me whether there was sufficient training happening, probably not, because it was assumed that the teachers that are in the classrooms from the previous homelands, etc., were qualified teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them would have been and others would not have been.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is still the price we're paying at the moment.
Mm-hmm. If you think back to, as these provincial administrations were being set up in different provinces, do you recall any examples of cases where premiers or their, the provincial administration as a whole were successfully, perhaps introducing strategies or mechanisms to deal with some of these issues around integration, around the quality of the incoming administration from the previous administrations?
I think there was a willingness, to deal with it from that perspective, and that was my experience. It was, it was not as if any of the provincial administrations, in my experience, we're trying to overthrow everything that existed before. It was rather accommodating and integrating.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, accepting that we now have a new democratic government. But, to put it again in the broader perspective, when the transition happened, let me put it differently, let me take one step back. The process of negotiations up to the point of the interim constitution was less than 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Which was relatively a short period of time. And those negotiations were aimed at finding a political settlement for South Africa, which resulted in the interim constitution. and in the end in the final constitution. But those negotiations were not primarily about, you know, setting up new administrations and things like that. It was almost the result of the transition that had to take care of that. We had a transitional executive council, as you might recall, in the period leading up to the transition in 1994. But that TEC only existed for about 4 months, very short period of time. Its aim was to ensure a proper takeover from the old to the new. And he did a good job within that space of time, but it was too limited time to attend to everything. And then the transition happened, which was a political takeover, democratization kicked in. And quite frankly, at that moment, I said to myself, it will take us 15 years to complete the transformation, the actual transformation of what we have created. And now it's 15 years. You know. Mm-hmm. And if you ask me today, where are we with transformation, I would say another 15 years. And probably after that, another 15 years. So it's an ongoing process. You know. One could not expect everything to be in place right from the start. And all the right things to be done. And in some areas, I think we neglected ourselves in terms of our responsibilities. In other areas, I think we did a damn good job. And I can name definitely a whole range of departments and a whole range of areas where we did a good job. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the new administration that took over after 1994. Mm-hmm. But we're still falling short of complying with our responsibility in many areas. And we're paying the price, like I said, and the biggest concern to me is education. Mm-hmm. But how we did it exactly at that stage was to bring about, first of all, the integration of the total nation as far as administration is concerned, as far as governance is concerned. Mm-hmm. And I think we succeeded in a broad sense in that way. But the actual implementation, getting people to do the job in the right way. Mm-hmm. Some, you would hear many voices today saying, well, you know, the new administration let us down because they fired all the experienced people and got new ones in. Now, to some extent, that was the result of affirmative action and so forth, which was a provision of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It probably could have been managed better in some ways. But on the other hand, there was no other way to get the imbalances of the past corrected. Mm-hmm. We needed affirmative action. It's an absolute fundamental requirement in our situation. And you needed new people to come in with less experience to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. So it was a relatively fast changeover. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're still seeing the results of that.
Okay. As we begin to wrap up, I'd like to ask quickly about the Commission on Provincial Government and how you regarded its function and what its relationship was to your ministry.
Well, they were based in the ministry or in the department at the time. The whole idea for them was actually to help and assist with the changeover, with the transformation from the old to the new. And I think they played a constructive role in that regard, and we worked very, very closely. So we had a good relationship, we had a good understanding. Tozamile Buta was the chairperson, together with Chol Autogan, and the two of them worked very good together and came with a lot of experience and so forth in terms of provincial administration. But again, you know, the challenge was probably bigger than what we realized. But From that perspective, we had a good relationship and we managed it, I think, pretty well in terms of that. Mm-hmm. But the demands and the jobs were much bigger than what a commission or a department could do. Mm-hmm.
For other people learning from this experience and this decision to set up a structure like that, what would you suggest could have been done differently to strengthen the role that it could play?
Well, you know, it's even difficult from hindsight to speak about this because I don't think there's very clear experiences or experiences we can take over from that and relate to others, because every situation would be different, you know. All the other conflict areas that I've been involved with have its own demands and needs as far as that is. But I think what we should have done probably was to start up with a process of real planning in terms of this, in conjunction or parallel to the negotiating process. And in that regard, we failed ourselves by letting ourselves only doing this within the last period of time, mm-hmm. before the transition. I think we were so consumed, all of us, mm-hmm. in our negotiations on finding a constitutional settlement, mm-hmm. that we didn't think really about the bigger consequences, mm-hmm. of what we were doing about creating a new state, creating a new administration at the national as well as at the provincial level. So that is the one thing I think we can take as a lesson from that. If you find yourself in a situation similar to that of South Africa, where you're bringing about literally a new state, like that on the 27th of April on one day in 1 year, then it's a big momentum. And you need a proper process of planning to make that happen, which goes much deeper than the political settlement and the political negotiations. And probably we should have realized that at a much earlier phase and doing the necessary planning, mm-hmm. in that regard. The second point, I think, is, you know, for those that became the ruling party after the transition, there was obviously a lot of excitement. And the focus immediately was at the national level. Mm-hmm. Those that didn't go from the struggle straight into national government actually went off into becoming business people, you know, seeking benefits from that angle. And I don't think there was sufficient attention given at the lower levels of government as to ensuring qualified people to get on with the jobs at those levels. And I'm not talking about politicians, I'm talking about administrations. And I think that's the other lesson that we should, you know, bear in mind, is that if you complete a process like this, which was, like I said, a political process mainly, you immediately have to think about how do you deploy, to use the popular word, how do you deploy people in administrations that really take responsibility for the delivery of services, and that is something where I think we also failed ourselves, mm-hmm. to a great extent. And that is why you're still seeing problems at the provincial at the local level. Mm-hmm. You know, some municipalities that just don't have the capacity today even to administer what they're supposed to administer. Mm-hmm. Some of them have bigger budgets than provinces, mm-hmm. like the. You know, the metropolitan structures. So I think that is something that one should keep in mind. Mm-hmm. And that is also a measure of real planning, mm-hmm. that is required as far as that is.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you very much.
But let me immediately say, I think there are areas where South Africa has performed itself, yeah. better than what we expected. Mm-hmm. You know, I really think so. If I look at how infrastructure is being managed, mm-hmm. at the broad level, mm-hmm. our road system is one of the best in the emerging world. Mm-hmm. Compare it with other countries in the emerging world, and we outperform them by far, our infrastructure. And those are also responsibilities at the provincial level. It's not only a responsibility at the national level. I'm using that as an example to say, you know, it's not what we're talking about. It's not all negative and bad. But there are certain areas which really, really, and I think the government realizes it today, and we have to do more about that. And that's particularly education and health.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us. You know, as we mentioned, this is designed to allow people such as yourself with this great experience to share your experience in addressing challenges that you face. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that you think we may have missed?
I think we've covered what I can contribute.
Fantastic.
But you have to talk to other specialists as well.
We will do. Thank you very much.